I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, the flow of drugs into the United States. Where are they coming from? How are they detected? How sophisticated cartels are in moving their product? And who holds the Drug Enforcement Agency accountable when its missions cost lives? We'll have two guests this hour, Sanho Tri, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Drug Policy Project, and later Ginger Thompson will join us, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's covered Mexico and other Central American countries for a number of years. She's now a senior reporter at ProPublica and recently wrote about a DEA operation that touched off a massacre in a Mexican town, but the agency never investigated what went wrong. Joining us now is Sanho Tri, fellow at the Institute of Policy Studies, and he looks at alternatives to prohibitionist drug policies and the war on drugs. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of the whole hour, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We love to read your comments there, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Sanho, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great pleasure. You've been studying this for a long time. Tell me, we have been hearing, and it's one of the reasons for the president deciding that he wanted to build a wall. I'm not sure what the status of this is at the moment. Would it be a useful tool in a war on drugs? Are there people crossing the border who are carrying lots of drugs with them?
Actually, no, they're not carrying it so much as they're moving it at industrial scales through things like tunnels and submarines and ultralights. It's not the people, the migrants, who are being forced to carry a couple of kilos on their backs along with water and their world possessions. You know, there's a tiny amount of drugs that are smuggled that way. And building a wall isn't going to put a dent in what's coming through at legal checkpoints. So the vast majority of those drugs are coming through regular ports of entry where they're able to smuggle them inside all kinds of nooks and crannies and trucks and SUVs and shoes and hidden in vegetables and fruits and that sort of thing. So most of that stuff is coming through quite legally. And building a bigger wall basically makes sure that more of it gets funneled through those existing checkpoints, and the corrupt people who are bribed at those places will basically be able to charge even more toll, if you will.
Tell me more about these narco subs. They can carry a huge number of tons per run, right?
Yeah, and so they can carry up to anywhere from 6 to 12 tons per run. They were originally built in the 90s out of fiberglass, and they were semi-submersibles. That is to say, they were 90% underwater and 10% stayed above water. And what they would do is they would travel by night. They would throw a blue tarp over themselves during the day, and they would blend into the ocean. As one DEA agent put it, you try finding something the size of a log floating in the Pacific Ocean. You know, good luck. Nonetheless, we did get better at detecting those small conning towers in the semi-submersibles. And so in more recent years, the traffickers have built fully submersible, proper submarines that can dive as much as 50 feet below water. And those are very hard to detect. And now they found even more efficient workarounds than submarines. They built narco torpedoes, which are like sleds that pods that can be either bolted underneath a vessel so that if you stop it, you don't see it unless you send divers underneath. Or more commonly, it'll be towed far behind a vessel using a very long cable. And if they're stopped, they'll cut the cable, they'll release the payload, and it's got a homing beacon, and it's instructed to surface every few hours and send an encrypted signal so that the follow-on ship far behind can pick up the package. Hmm. They're quite ingenious at this.
Yeah, I guess so.
And the wall is not going to stop the tunnels. It's not going to stop the most basic countermeasures. One of the first things the cartels did was they built ramps. You have a 20-foot wall, they'll build a 21-foot ramp. And they literally drive SUVs over the existing wall that's there. And they've also resorted to, 2,000, 3,000-year-old technology, catapults. So they're actually flinging hundreds of pounds of drugs in these giant bales of drugs over the wall so their accomplices can pick it up on the other side. They also use T-shirt cannons. They've adapted those things to shoot 100-pound bales of drugs over the wall using a pneumatic cannon mounted on the back of a pickup truck. So there are an infinite number of countermeasures to a static defense like a wall.
And you talk about drones as well, used for heroin and meth because it's a high-value thing and you don't need to carry a whole lot to make a whole lot of money.
Exactly. And they're actually getting involved in more higher-capacity drones as well. They can carry significant payloads. So these are, and right now they're using manned ultralight craft. So that's, you know, they can fly underneath the radar, but over the wall. And drones take it one step further because there's no pilot to capture and snitch. So it's much more secure that way.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, where are the drugs coming from the, for the most part? And are farmers, as is the case in Afghanistan, growing poppies because they're very profitable for them, and it's much harder to make a living growing other kinds of crops?
Yeah, actually, we're not receiving that much of the Afghan poppy, even though it's a huge amount of the global supply. The United States is serviced by Mexico and Colombia and, to a lesser extent, Guatemala. That's where poppies are being grown in this hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to the heroin coming from those sources, it's being cut increasingly with fentanyl and its fentanyl analogs, which are many times more powerful than heroin and extremely dangerous. That's what's killing people today for the most part. It's not that heroin or prescription opioid drugs are that much more powerful. They're the same drugs they've always been. What's different now is that traffickers are cutting their supply of heroin with fentanyl and other even more potent variations. And it's very easy to overdose on that stuff. So they do it to stretch their profits. So if a wall actually succeeds in stopping, let's say, 20%, 50% of the heroin coming in the country, the question we have to ask ourselves, and ask the DEA in particular, how are traffickers going to respond if we start significantly reducing the amount of heroin coming to this country? Market forces suggest that they're going to do what they've been doing already, which is adding more fentanyl into the mix, driving up overdose rates, astronomically, in my opinion, if that happens.
When I look at your resume, it says that you are promoting alternatives to the prohibitionist models. What are those alternatives, Sanjal?
Well, first of all, let's understand where the value, why people are doing what they're doing right now in terms of drug trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you think about these cartels and the amount of violence and corruption that goes along with this, they're doing it for the right to distribute what are essentially minimally processed agricultural and chemical commodities. Things like marijuana, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, fentanyl. These are substances that are incredibly cheap to produce, pennies per dose to produce in a real market.
Really?
Yeah. So there's nothing exotic about these plants and these chemicals at all. You can produce them at an industrial scale very, very cheaply. It's our policies of drug prohibition, the war on drugs, that gives them their incredible price support, if you will. That's what the drug war has done, is given a price support to drug traffickers, or a crop subsidy, if you will. So that the higher the risk to each person in the smuggling chain, our politicians threaten more enforcement, longer jail sentences, higher risk to traffickers. Well, the higher the risk of the trafficker, the longer the sentence they may have to serve or the more danger to them, the more risk premium they're able to charge the next person down the smuggling chain. And so this commodity builds up, it snowballs in value as it reaches the final destination. And the more risky the border it's crossing, the higher the risk premium that's involved.
Mm-hmm.
So you can buy a kilo of pure cocaine in the streets of Medellin, Colombia, for about $1,500, give or take. By the time you smuggle that kilo to the streets of Washington, D.C. or New York or Chicago, and by the time the dealers cut it up into little gram baggies and they dilute it with whatever chemicals they're going to, dilute the stuff with, they can get about $150,000 for that exact same kilo.
Whoa!
So what users are paying for in the streets are essentially transportation costs, or more accurately, the risks associated with transportation. So this is the catch-22 of the drug war. Our politicians see this problem, and their instinctive solution is to crack down. But the more you crack down, the more valuable the drugs become. If you try to constrict supply while the demand remains the same or even increases, you're going to increase profits for these people. And so the more valuable the drugs become, the more people want to enter this market. So that's why we're not winning the drug war. We keep throwing water onto the fire as though that's common sense thing to do. And most of your listeners will think, well, that is the common sense thing to do. That's how you put out a fire. You throw water onto it.
Right.
In this case, a water is a metaphor for military and police assistance. Well, have you ever had a grease fire in your kitchen or
sure.
electrical fire?
Mm-hmm.
Right? The last thing you want to do is throw water onto it because it'll make it explode. Look at it in a different way. If you're making French fries and that pot of oil catches on fire, you don't want to throw water on it. You want to calm down and reason it out. And you realize that putting the lid under the pot, cutting off the oxygen, is the way to put out that fire, right? And in this case, oxygen is drug prohibition and demand in the United States. So there's an inexhaustible reservoir of poor people, greedy people, vicious people who will fill that vacuum to meet that demand as long as that demand is there. And so it's the black market forces that create this mess that we see, much like alcohol prohibition. Once we re-legalized alcohol after a prohibition, you never again saw, you know, gangsters machine gunning each other over the right to distribute alcohol. You know, people stopped dying of contaminated alcohol because they can go to a liquor store and buy proper regulated alcohol. So that's what I'm talking about in terms of reducing the harms caused by prohibition itself.
So you think that all of these drugs should be legalized?
No. Let's be very clear about what Americans, unfortunately, are trained to think in terms of simple dichotomies, A or B, good or bad, black or white. And I've been accused of you know, wanting to sell heroin and candy machines to children because I don't support prohibition or that I don't believe in the drug war. In fact, there is a whole spectrum, a rainbow of regulatory possibilities with each drug, and each drug is different, and they should be regulated differently, some more strictly and some more liberally. But it doesn't mean that just because you don't want to, we don't want to have this, you know, all-out blanket, one-size-fits-all, you know, get a bigger hammer approach to things, doesn't mean we have to criminalize this at each step of the way. And it's a process of criminalization in the face of high demand that produces all these black market problems that we see.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about the demand, Sanho. Is it growing? Is there a demand for a certain kind of drug? Why is there a demand at all?
A lot of the things are cyclical, and they become more fashionable after a while or less fashionable. When I was in high school in the 80s, for instance, crack was very popular, but it created such a stigma and such a had such bad portrayal of it that the next cohort, the next generation, tended to skip that drug, for instance. Heroin is also fairly cyclical in our history of drug use in the United States. But also it's tied into big pharma and their marketing of new types of opioids like OxyContin starting in the late 90s. And it's also it's combined with a pill culture, I would call it. So that starting in 1997, our country began there are only two countries in the world that allow direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceutical drugs, New Zealand and the United States. Hmm. New Zealand doesn't have a First Amendment to worry about. So that the idea that there's a pill for every problem, that you don't need to change your lifestyle or exercise or diet or anything, these lifestyle drugs are incredibly profitable. And it began with Bob Dole pitching Viagra back in the late 90s, right?
Oh, I forgot about that. Yes, he did.
Yeah, and he broke a barrier. They used to think that, well, if you had to list all the side effects of these drugs, people wouldn't take them. And we've now learned how wrong we were about that assumption. In fact, you know, two-thirds of these ads you see on TV, the two-thirds of the ads is listing all the side effects, but they mumble them so quickly that we're trained to just, you know, stop thinking about them. And it's hard to turn on cable news without seeing drug ad after drug ad after drug ad. And so you have an entire generation of kids now, college-age kids now, who have grown up in an environment where they cannot recall a day when you could turn on the TV and not see drug ads all over the place. And so that, I think, creates a culture where people think, well, if the drugs are advertised on TV, if even though opioids aren't, but you know, if it came from a factory that's been inspected by an inspector, it comes in a sealed foil pack, it's been prescribed by a doctor on a prescription pad, and the government allows it, it must somehow be safe. And that is not the case necessarily. If you mix the drugs, if you abuse them, they can kill you just as quickly as street drugs. And so that's part of the problem as well.
Mm-hmm. And the people who are involved in moving these drugs, tell me about the whole process. If you are in Colombia, if you're in Mexico, and you're getting them from what kind of supply in that country, and then how does it move through? Who's making money along the way? How much money is involved? And what would a better process be?
It's the cartels, the people in the middle who are making the bulk of the profits. So the peasant farmers we've been attacking over two decades now in Colombia, trying to fumigate them, spray them with a very potent form of Roundup, trying to destroy these drug crops in the ground, which has been about as effective as shoveling water, basically. Mm. There's simply too much land area and not enough state presence to stop farmers from growing these things. So keep in mind that Colombia is bigger than Texas and California combined. The same is true of Peru. The same is true of Bolivia. These are the three major coca-producing countries in the world. And trying to eradicate this one plant from these countries is like trying to eradicate dandelions from Texas. Mm-hmm. I mean, good luck doing that. It's not going to work. And so we've tried that for many years. We destroyed a lot of farmers' lives and the environment in the Amazon, and that hasn't worked. So the farmers aren't the ones making the profit off of this. It's the cartels, it's the armed actors, whether they're guerrillas or paramilitaries or drug traffickers. They're the ones moving the stuff, getting it refined, and then it passes hands many different times through different cartels, it's constantly shifting sands, right, in terms of who's controlling what area and what method they're using to smuggle across the borders. They're always modulating their tactics in response to law enforcement. But what we have done with an excessive reliance in law enforcement, and I do believe in law enforcement, I just don't believe in the strategy that we're enforcing right now. But what it's done is created a filtering effect. We've created tremendous efficiency in the drug trafficking world, because as we throw more military and police resources at this problem decade after decade, the people we tend to capture tend to be the people who are dumb enough to get caught, right? The clumsy traffickers, they're the ones who made mistakes, who screwed up, and mm-hmm. then they got busted. Conversely, the people we tend to miss decade after decade are the most efficient, the most adaptable, the most cunning, not necessarily the most violent. The violence is not a good indicator of longevity in this business.
Mm-hmm.
But the most intelligent ones are the ones that survive. We created a Darwinian evolution. We've been selectively breeding super traffickers, if you will.
And once the drugs get into the United States, is there a whole different system? What is the system that gets drugs to people here?
There are lots of different methods. So there are various cartels. Whether they have operational reach into the major cities of the United States, or whether it's just their product that's being channeled through local gangs, is constantly shifting, and it's hard to penetrate those things. But it's a very efficient but costly means of distribution. And so that's what I described earlier. Of we have this incredibly expensive distribution system for what users are actually paying for on the streets.
Sanho Tree is our guest, the first part of this hour, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He is director of the Drug Policy Project, a former military and diplomatic historian, and his work is on reform of international and domestic drug policies by promoting alternatives to the prohibitionist models and establishing humane and sustainable alternatives to the drug war. He's been featured in many documentaries. We go to your phone calls, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Later in the hour, Ginger Thompson, senior reporter at ProPublica, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has spent many, many years covering Mexico and other Central American countries and the war on drugs. And she'll tell us about a DEA mission that went terribly wrong. This is the Ideas Network. All right, to your many phone calls coming in, Muhammad in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen and your guests. I wanted to answer your question, just a fraction of your question about how do the drugs, once they get across the border, get up to various points like Chicago, New York, and so forth. When I moved from Madison in 2014, and I lived in Arizona metropolitan Phoenix for a couple of years. And I stayed with my grandson's father, and when I stayed with him, moved in, they let me put my car in their garage. And about 3 days later, he wasn't there. Two guys that were staying at the apartment came and said, Abu, we need you to move your vehicle out of the garage. I never put my vehicle back in the garage after that. What I could hear, I didn't go out there, but I could hear them taking a car apart. They had their shirts off there. You could see all kinds of wrapping materials in the garage. And when I moved, my grandson's father asked me where I'd moved to. And I said, I live in downtown Mesa. He said, do you have a garage? I said, no. He said, you should have gotten an apartment with a garage. So then what they do is they get what they call mules, sometimes three females, to drive that car from Arizona up to points north and east. And that's sort of how that moves around. Sometimes you'll be driving through palatial or middle-class areas in metropolitan Phoenix, and you'll see a Mexican couple living there. Kids, they're going to school. They never go in the garage. So that's sort of, how that stuff gets distributed. I'm a Muslim imam. I wish they would decriminalize at least marijuana. The people are getting locked up in one state for things people can do in another state makes no sense. And just recently we had a home invasion here in Madison. These guys robbed this guy, killed him to get marijuana he was selling. We just need to take that element and the criminal element out of something that's so widely used now in America.
Thanks, Mohammed, for the call. Sanho.
Yeah, I think, you know, the caller is quite right, especially on the issue of cannabis. There's no reason people should be killing each other over this plant. We call it weed for a reason. It grows very much like a weed. It's a little bit more difficult to grow indoors, but nonetheless, at the end of the day, it's a minimally processed agricultural commodity that is not expensive to produce.
Thanks, Mohammed, for the call. Let's go next to Tyler in Oshkosh. Hi, Tyler.
Hi, good afternoon to both of you. First off, I'd just like to 100% agree with your guest. I think decriminalization is absolutely necessary. Especially necessary in the realm of psychedelic drugs. I think that the government, ever since the 60s, has the main reason they have resisted legalizing marijuana, LSD, other drugs like that, is because they fear social ramifications. But my main point I called in was, speaking of big pharma, now there's a lot of push for recovering heroin addicts or other opiate addicts to get on drugs like methadone or Suboxone. And speaking as a opiate addict, I have now been on methadone for 12 years, and it is impossible to get off of. It is, and I know there are a lot of people who've benefited from it, but it is very difficult and very addictive in itself. So it's kind of a catch-22. It's like you get addicted by Big Pharma, and then Big Pharma makes money off of re-addicting you to another drug. It's a very strange dichotomy, and I'll take anything off the air.
Thanks very much, Tyler Sanho.
I think, you know, we need to look at what other countries are doing in response to this crisis. So, for instance, British Columbia in Canada, they're being hit just as hard from fentanyl and fentanyl analogs as the United States. Hundreds of people have overdosed in the Vancouver area. What they're doing is they've had since the early 2000s. The first safe injection site in North America called InSite. They've opened several more in Canada now, where these are medically supervised injection centers where people who are injection drug users can go to a clean facility that's supervised by either a nurse or a physician and use the drugs that they bring on premises. And they've never had a fatal overdose in any of these places around the world where they've operated these things. And so it dramatically brings down the overdose rate and gives people a point of access for public health and harm reduction services when they're ready to give up drugs. Mm-hmm. In terms of methadone and medication-assisted treatment, I think it's an important element for a lot of people, and different people respond differently to different treatment modalities. For those who haven't been able to respond to any of the major treatment modalities, abstinence hadn't worked, methadone hasn't worked, and they're still intent on using heroin, Canada is moving towards prescription heroin, as have other countries,
really?
Like Switzerland and the UK, where for the most seriously affected people who have shown that they failed at every other treatment modality and are intent on continuing to use, then it makes sense for the state to step in and say, we'd rather you didn't do this, but if you're going to do this, we'd rather you didn't kill yourself by gambling with street opioids. We're going to provide pharmaceutically pure heroin, which is actually much safer than what you get on the streets, even though it's more pure, right? It's counterintuitive, as is so much with drug policy. But it's a known dose, and it's pure. It doesn't have all the other garbage people cut it with that really destroys people's organs and veins and stuff. And it's a way of keeping people alive to the point where they when they are ready to give up the heroin, they haven't overdosed, contracted hepatitis C or HIV, or destroyed their community, their neighborhood, and everything around them. They're not given, higher and higher doses. They can't keep chasing the dragon, as the expression goes, to get higher and higher. They're giving maintenance doses, so they don't go into withdrawal, which is what most addicts are afraid of. They're afraid of going to withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you do that, something, again, counterintuitive happens. It opens up a lot of mental space. People think of heroin addicts as being some lethargic, lazy people, but in fact, they're some of the most industrious people you'll ever meet. The problem is, under our system, they only apply their industry to one thing. Where is my next fix going to come from? Is the dealer going to be there? Is the stuff going to be any good? Do I have enough money? If I don't have money, do I need to turn tricks? Do I need to steal something? If I steal it, where do I fence it, et cetera? And so your entire mental space is on this treadmill, like a hamster on a treadmill. And as soon as you get that heroin, you inject, and you're back on it again on the same treadmill. What heroin maintenance does is say, okay, we're going to make sure you don't go into withdrawal. But suddenly it frees up a lot of mental space. They can think about other things. For instance, a young woman, say 24 years old, walks into a doctor's office. She gets, for the first time, a prescription for pharmaceutically pure heroin. They can get it at the chemist under the national healthcare system in the UK or some other country. And they can begin thinking about things for the first time very often. You know, I've got a 3-year-old son. I've got a 4-year-old daughter. Where have I been for their life? Stuff doesn't get me high anymore. It just keeps me from going to withdrawal. I'd rather not have this chemical ball and chain. Doc, I'd like to get you, I would like you to get me off of this. Get me into a treatment slot. Mm. So that you can do without hitting rock bottom, which is what we have to do here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you've hit rock bottom, if you're lucky, you haven't overdosed and killed yourself. You haven't contracted some disease. And you haven't ended up in prison. And you might qualify for a rare underfunded public treatment slot. Then you might have a chance of turning your life around. So heroin maintenance programs is a radical way of approaching the same problem in a very counterintuitive way that can very often, though not always, can very often produce radically better results.
Mm, interesting. It's hard to imagine that happening in this country, however, at this point in time, don't you think?
As Canada adopts this, I think it gradually crosses the border. These ideas start crossing the border, and people are looking at cannabis, for instance, in the 8 states plus D.C. that have legalized it. And if you can say, well, look, if we take something that was, previously demonized and we fought this very expensive domestic war against this stuff, and now we're able to regulate it, control it, keep it out of the hands of minors for the most part, and reduce the violence and get revenue to fund more treatment and prevention and education, it's a radically different way of approaching an age-old problem that we've had.
Mm-hmm. Sanho, thank you very much for being with us. You'll have to join us again when we can speak for the whole hour. It was fascinating. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Sanho Tree, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's served as director of the Institute's drug policy project since 1988 and studies alternatives to prohibitionist drug policies and the war on drugs. Joining us now is Ginger Thompson. Ginger is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. She's a senior reporter now at ProPublica, and she's worked at the New York Times. Also, she's covered Mexico and other Central American countries and the war on drugs and has done so for a number of years. She wrote a very interesting ProPublica piece in conjunction with the Washington Post titled, "Who Holds the DEA Accountable When Its Missions Cost Lives." In 2011, a DEA operation touched off a massacre in a Mexican town, yet the agency never investigated what went wrong. Ginger is with us now. Hi, Ginger. Thanks so very much for being with us.
Hi there, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. So tell us the story of the massacre in a Mexican town. What happened?
So in March of 2011, it was a Friday evening, a holiday weekend, a convoy of gunmen arrived on at the town of Allende and at towns surrounding Allende and began kidnapping dozens of people. They took many of their victims to a ranch on the outskirts of town in full view of the town, in full view of police officers, in full view of a military outpost nearby. They gathered up these people, took them to a ranch on the outskirts of Allende, killed them, and then burned their bodies.
Mm. And they did that for what reason?
Well, so what we learned was that this massacre, what sets it apart from so many tragedies like this one in Mexico, is that its origins were in the United States. This attack began with a DEA operation on the U.S. side of the border in Dallas, where a DEA agent had scored essentially an intelligence coup. He had gotten an informant who was inside the Zetas cartel, which at the time was one of the most violent drug trafficking organizations in the world. He convinced this informant to get him the phone numbers for the leaders of the Zetas cartel, not just the phone numbers that you dial, but their PIN numbers, which are trackable numbers attached to all of our cell phones that allow authorities to track the movements of the owner of whatever cell phone they have the number for. The DEA, against the wishes of its own informants, the informant in particular who provided them those numbers, shared those numbers with Mexico, hoping that its counterparts in a specially vetted unit, a unit that was vetted and trained by the DEA itself, would help them capture the leaders of the Zetas cartel. Instead, those numbers leaked right back to the Zetas, who realized instantly that there was a traitor in their midst, and they began looking for the traitors. And when they couldn't find the people they suspected of betraying them, they went after those people's families and their friends.
So there was also an informant in the police department.
Well, there was. The problem with in Mexico, as many people know, is that corruption runs rampant in so many government institutions, and there was someone in that agency, in the Mexican Federal Police Force, who filtered that information to the Zetas.
And for years, you write, Mexican authorities did next to nothing to investigate this massacre. And I guess the lesson that you learn if you're in the Allende or in other parts of the country where this has happened, too, is you just keep your mouth shut.
Right. And many people, in fact, refused to talk about this. There were some family members who, in the wake of this attack, attempted to seek help from Mexican authorities and found that when they did, they began receiving death threats as well. And so they withdrew their complaints. And so for years, the Mexican government essentially ignored what happened there. And so an investigation didn't begin, a real investigation didn't begin for 3 years.
And in terms of the DEA, how should they have handled this? They got this tip from an informant. Instead of letting the Mexican authorities, the police force, know about it, what would have been a better way to handle all of this to escape this horrible violence?
Well, I think that, you know, there was an understanding in the DEA clearly that this unit had a history of problems with keeping sensitive information out of the hands of bad guys. This was not the first time that information had leaked. This is perhaps one of the most tragic consequences of such leaks. When these leaks typically happen, a bad guy gets away. The problem is that the United States doesn't have a lot of great options when it comes to sharing sensitive information with Mexico. There are risks to sharing information with governments where corruption and impunity run as rampant as they do in Mexico. I think for us, the larger question is accountability, and I don't think that the United States can get away from cooperating with Mexico in the fight against organized criminals, particularly when we contribute so clearly to Mexico's problem with drug traffickers. The reason so many drugs flow through Mexico is to reach our markets in the United States. But I do believe that the accountability question is the more pressing one, and that is, what are the protocols for sharing information? How much are those decisions reviewed? And when consequences like these happen, who's held accountable for them? What kind of investigation happens? What kind of reporting is required? And those are the questions that we hope are raised by this story.
Mm-hmm. And you remind us that American taxpayers have pumped hundreds of millions of dollars into Mexico's counter-narcotics programs over the years. But you also say, other than a vague list of kingpins who've been arrested and the occasional made-for-TV photo op of seized drugs, there is almost no public accounting of what those efforts have accomplished.
Right. I mean, it's very hard to get a really clear record, for example, of this vetted unit and its successes and its failures. And the United States began creating vetted units in Mexico in 1996. And since I've been reporting about Mexico, these units have been made and remade several times, either because they've been infiltrated by drug traffickers or because Mexico has overhauled completely its federal police force, and that means the vetted unit gets overhauled as well. Or sometimes it's both of those things at the same time. And we've never really gotten... there's never been a full accounting of, you know, how many people have been trained, what has happened to those people, how many of them ended up funneling information to bad guys, how many of them went on to great careers mm-hmm. in the Mexican security forces. We just don't know what happens to all the money we're pumping into these programs.
Mm. Ginger, I know you spent most of the last year looking at this attack on Allende. You did recording of those who had lived through it. Tell me about who you talked to and what you heard.
Well, we were able to talk to a wide range of people, everyone from a guy who was a hot dog vendor in the main square at the time of the attack to council people who served in the municipal government at the time of the attack to, you know, relatives of victims, a mother of a 15-year-old high school football player who had just been hanging out with friends, had nothing to do with either the Zetas or the leak, who was kidnapped and killed in this attack. You know, we talked to mayors and former mayors who had to watch as their towns fell under the control of the Zetas cartel. And one of our goals in doing all of this was to not only describe, you know, how the massacre was triggered, but to explain how it is that drug traffickers take control of these towns and then how powerless these towns are to defend themselves from attack.
Mm-hmm. Is this a large cartel, the Zetas cartel?
They were one of the largest in the country at the time, certainly one of the most powerful. They were an offshoot of the Gulf cartel. They had started as an enforcement group for the Gulf cartel who recruited former military or rogue military agents to provide protection to the leaders of the Gulf cartel. And in 2010, they broke away from the Gulf cartel and became an independent group on their own.
Mm-hmm. And who joins a group like that? What's in it for people to be members of such a murderous group?
Money.
Really?
Money.
It's
was
money.
Largely, you know, among the other people I was able to interview for this story were former Zetas operatives who are now cooperating with American authorities in the United States. And a lot of the reason that they talk about being involved with this organization was money. And, of course, they all say that they had nothing to do with the killing part. And in some cases, the people I spoke to, I believe that. They were in it for the money. They sort of turned a blind eye to sort of the ruthlessness that accompanied the drug trafficking.
And they're now cooperating with U.S. authorities because?
Because they, in this particular case, because when the Zetas learned that one of the members of their cell had betrayed them and shared information with the DEA, that put all of them at risk of being killed. And so they fled to the United States as the attack was happening, as the attack on Allende was happening. They fled to the United States and asked for leniency and protection in the United States, and in exchange for providing information about the Setas cartel to authorities in the United States, they've all received lenient sentences here.
Are there programs in Mexico, counter-narcotics programs, their own war on drugs program, that have been successful in breaking up the cartels?
I think that the cartels, breaking up the cartels is something that Mexico has done, Mexico and the United States have done a good job on over the last 10 years. They've, you know, managed to take down several important kingpins. But what happens is the groups split apart. They often split apart violently. There are people that live in the crossfire of those splits. And so it often, those, you know, taking out the kingpin can often trigger more violence than when the kingpin was there. And the community, the people that suffer the most from that fallout are Mexican communities, not communities in the United States. These groups will then reorganize themselves. So you can take the Setas out today, but a new version of the Setas will form tomorrow. You can take the, you know, the Sinaloa cartel, but you'll have a nueva generación, a new generation of these cartels that will appear tomorrow. So there's, you know, I think there are legitimate questions about whether or not the way that we're pursuing the disruption of these cartels is really having a long-term impact. It has a short-term impact in that the leaders of those cartels are gone, the cartel is disrupted temporarily, but they, the money is so important. There's so much money involved in this business that they're, that these groups will reorganize. And they will find a way to keep the profits coming in.
Ginger Thompson is our guest this half hour, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. She's a senior reporter at ProPublica, worked for the New York Times for a number of years. She covers Mexico and other Central American countries and the war on drugs. And she wrote a piece, a collaboration between ProPublica and the Washington Post, on one particular, it's an understatement to say that it went awry, but a DEA operation that really touched off a massacre in the town in Mexico of Allende. And her ProPublica piece, which is on our Facebook page and worth reading, that's the Kathleen Dunn Show, it describes what happened. She spent a year talking to people who documenting the attack on Allende and recording accounts from those people who lived through it. Many didn't. All right, two more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network. Okay, phone calls now for Ginger. Dan in Green Bay, hi.
Yeah, hey, you know, at the end of the day, it's a demand problem because as long as there's tons of money to be made, there's always going to be criminals who will step up and take their place. I do feel for that DEA agent because what was his alternative? We would have had to send in our own police and our own military, and not inform the Mexicans at all, sort of like we do in Pakistan, or send a drone over or something to eliminate them. So I just want to know what your guests would suggest, you know, besides taking the demand and lowering the price, what else was that guy supposed to do?
Thank you for your question. I think it's a really good one. And I, too, feel for this agent because the little that I was able to learn about him, and I was able to have one conversation with him, is a very moving conversation. My sense from my reporting is that he didn't want to have this information shared with the Mexicans either because he, like his informant, knew better than anyone just how much control the Setas had over the state of Coahuila and just how corrupt the Mexican government was in terms of the pursuit of the Setas at the time. So this was not his call. But I think in situations like this one, just in terms of the decisions that could have been made about this particular piece of intelligence, you know, we could have decided not to use it in that way. We simply could have decided that the risk was too high, that the information was fantastic, but the risk was too high. And it's, you know, you have to sort of think about what the potentially worst thing is that could happen as a result of sharing this information. And I don't know that there was ever sort of time to really think about that. The DEA tells me that it's very hard to to spend time thinking like that when you've got information like this, because the set does change their phone numbers all the time, precisely because they want to avoid detection. And so by its very nature, information exchanges have to move quickly. I think, however, what we don't do as carefully as we could, and I think it's perhaps because these operations happen in Mexico, is stop and think and really take a hard look at what the potential cost could be. And so my feeling is that if we're going to operate in Mexico, we have to consider the safety of those communities precisely the way we would consider the safety of our own people.
Mm-hmm.
I agree that, you know, certainly the United States is driving a lot of the drug trade, absolutely. And we can talk all day about whether we should legalize or whether, you know, we should just get out of Mexico at all. But when you ask me about that specific piece of information, that's how I feel about it.
And this happened, Ginger, in 2011. Have the Mexican police forces, those responsible directly for dealing with cartels, become less corrupt?
Well, what has happened, I know, in the wake of this operation, for example, the prosecutor who was involved in the case told me that he made clear to the DEA that he only wanted information shared with the Mexican Marines, which is, you know, a different unit of the Mexican military that has proven to be a much more reliable conduit of sensitive information and has been responsible for several significant captures, including the capture of one of these Trevino brothers who were responsible for the Allende attack.
Thanks, Dan, so much for your call. Let's go to Dean in Appleton. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Just a couple of real quick points here. You have to live in Mexico to understand the mentality down there. Number one, we have guns. They don't have guns. These people don't have a right to defend themselves. The only people who have guns are the violent criminals and the police who support the criminal element. The police are more criminal than the criminal in Mexico. And you can't count on them to come to your rescue. As a reference and point, I use the, I don't know if it was Cuernavaca, the college kids that were kidnapped and murdered, nothing's ever happened. It's the same incident in Mexico constantly. You give the people a right to defend themselves. And the second point is this. It's the Don Padron mentality down there. You aspire to money because once you have money, people respect it just like they respect Donald Trump here. Good or bad for Donald Trump, I'm not going to say my point of view. But when you go to that level of monetary influence, which is even more in Mexico, you have people aspiring to whatever it takes to survive.
I think that's true all over. We have our share of this in this country as well. If you think if there were more guns in Mexico, there would be less of a problem, Ginger?
Look, I think that your caller makes some good points. I think that actually Mexico is awash in guns. They're not all legally owned, but the country is awash in guns. And yes, the people with the biggest guns are the organized criminals and the military. And yes, there is a problem with corruption among Mexican police, which is why so many of the people in my story knew that they couldn't go to the authorities for help when this was happening. But I don't think that, you know, that Mexicans have some mindset that is different than ours. They are dealing with a different reality than we are. And that reality forces them to make choices and to live their lives in ways that are different. But they are very much like any other person. They are, you know, law-abiding, and they want the best for their kids, and they want the best for their communities. But they live in a country where institutions are not particularly reliable to them, and where sometimes the people with the, you know, the biggest guns are the ones that have the most power. And I think they, you know, try their best to build lives in that, you know, very difficult reality.
Mm-hmm. Ginger, thank you so much for your reporting, which is exquisite and important, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ginger Thompson, she is a senior reporter at ProPublica. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, was with the New York Times for a number of years. This piece is on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. It is done in conjunction with The Washington Post.